And welcome back to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires, our Week in Sports Cars episode. We have our friend Chris Simmons, race engineer for Scott Dixon, your current championship leader. We're going to move right into this new separate Q&A section for the week. And Chris, I'm telling you, I don't know what you did, but maybe it's all the awesome help you've been giving me and others with questions and stories and other things that we've done over the years. You have had more questions come in than most people do, and so I think that's great, especially for your first stint here as co-pilot on the week in IndyCar. As I mentioned in the opening of our little insight and discussion portion, Justice Brothers are supporting the Marshall Pruitt Podcast this month of July. Their additives, lubricants, and cleaners have been and continue to be America's brand for quality. And their products are definitely used and proven by some of the world's top racing teams. I have been using them for many years myself, so also maybe a little bit of a positive endorsement there. And they're looking to grow their sales and distribution team. So if you visit justicebrothers.com, you can find out about all they have in the automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial markets that might pique your interest. And also, Chris, as we do each week when we kick off the Q&A section, our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com give away a free t-shirt. We're actually out of mugs right now, and we're down to large and extra large t-shirts. We're about to run a brand new t-shirt series that'll be coming out, but we have a few of the previous ones left. So if you want to check out TorontoMotorsports.com, not only will you get 25% off of everything through July 8th if you use the code special to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast of Indy, uppercase I-N-D-Y, but also we are going to select my favorite question from last week and send a t-shirt to Adam Smith. Adam, your question to myself and our guest last week, Lee Diffie. Of the both of you, if Quentin Tarantino has contacted you about making a movie about your career in motorsports, which actor do you select to play your character? I believe Lee was still kind of fumbling a little bit to come up with one. I happened to pick Nick Offerman for me, Chris. So anyways, but Adam, send me a little DM here and we'll get your address and get a t-shirt headed your way. And with all that,
not very often yet, Lee, at a loss for words, is it?
I know. Well, quality words too. God, that guy has nothing to say. It's pure garbage all the time. No, we love our boy Stiffy. All right, so you've again, man. I'm so stoked that you have so many folks who want to connect and get some insights here. Going to try and consolidate things a little bit because we do have a fair number of folks asking similar things both on Facebook and Twitter. Let's start with one. Ooh, I love this from Donald Gowron. Very first one that came in and, you know, put us on our heels a little bit. Chris, if for whatever reason Scott were to leave the team, who'd be more successful and win first? Scott with his new team or you, Mike Hole, and the rest of the crew with your new driver in the number 9 Chip Ganassi Racing Honda? I love it. We're driving a wedge just to start here. This is great.
That's a tough one. I mean, we think we're pretty good at Chip Ganassi Racing, but Dixon's record speaks for itself. So, you know, a lot would depend on who we were able to find to replace him. I know negotiations are ongoing, and certainly I'd like to do many more years with Scott, and I think every engineer in the paddock would. But
we don't want to see the Ginger Ninja.
That's a tough question.
Yeah, and Donald, we don't want to see the Ginger Ninja leave Chip Ganassi Racing anytime soon. And this is me filling in, not Chris. We haven't heard much in the way of positive things on the topic of that certain Formula One team that has inquired about Dixie's availability to drive an IndyCar. So unless some things change there, I hope for stability's sake and Chris's sake and everyone's sake, that they go and get go get many more years to play together because it's just one of IndyCar's ongoing best stories. Also, fair point. Does Ricardo Juncos come into $500 million and sign Dixon in your question here? You know, if Dixie is with Juncos, they would get to victory lane eventually. But I would have to say that you could bolt in any good driver into that number 9 car, and they'd probably get first because they are ready to win right away. Jordan Darwin says, Chris, how big of an upgrade are the custom anti-roll bars that IndyCar now allows teams to make, and what part of the chassis would you like to see opened up next?
Well, as engineers, we'd like to see it all open. I think right now, if we could pick a part of the car, it'd probably be the Speedway front wing would probably be where we see the biggest gains are probably available. You know, it's been talked about a bit, the struggles the drivers had in traffic. I know that IndyCar is working on that. I really like the approach they've taken to doing their homework behind the scenes and then coming up with a few options, getting some teams to test them, and then picking what they think is maybe not exactly what the teams would pick, but what is what IndyCar wants to put on as a product for the fans to see. And I think, you know, they did a really good job with the UAK 18 this year. It looks good. It races good. Is it perfect? No. And they know it and they're working on it. And I think it's refreshing to see that work going on in a controlled and structured manner with a goal in mind and a progression to get there.
How about the opening up on the anti-roll bar side? I know that the Dale Coyne team, for example, was really proud of a product they had designed and were hoping to implement, but IndyCar shot that down based on materials used and some of the lightning pockets that were included, and were afraid that that might, you know, if they allowed that, that could then become an anti-roll bar arms race and such. But how much leeway do you think you have to, I guess, personalize the anti-roll bar design experience? And how much of an influence does that have on your ability to tune the car closer to your driver's liking?
Well, there's a couple things you can do in the design process, and I think if you look at what they did with that design, you can change the stiffness and the range, so you can give your car, you can put it right in the stiffness range that you want for a given track or setup, and you can also design it so that there's more range and adjustability. So as the tires wear, the track conditions change, the driver is able to tune the car in throughout the stint and throughout the race. The other thing that they did that maybe got a little further than what IndyCar was comfortable with was they made the thing a lot lighter. You know, they did a tremendous job of doing FEA with their partners and finding where they needed the metal and where they don't. And, you know, every time we do something on the cars that we can design ourselves, we're looking at that weight and performance. So weight never sleeps. You know, and the lighter you can make the car, even though there's a weight limit, then it gives you some flexibility on ballast. So it's one of the things we work on all the time. Funny enough, it's not one of the things we've put a lot of work into at Chip Ganassi Racing so far. We've been fairly happy with the performance of the roll bars. We've made a few, I would say, reliability updates to some of our anti-roll bars. But we haven't done a top-to-bottom redesign yet. Not because I don't think it's worthwhile, it just hasn't made it the top of the list yet. So we constantly have a list of things that we want to work on, and we try to work on the ones that we think are going to give us the most bang for the buck first, and that one just hasn't made it to the top yet.
Jordan has another question. We get this every couple of weeks, but not always able to answer it as authoritatively as you might be able to. Jordan says, how many chassis do you use or keep in rotation for the number 9 entry, and how do you choose what you use where at specific tracks?
We bring two cars for Scott and two cars for Ed to each track, so we bring four chassis across the team to each track, primary and spare. Since we were a four-car team last year, we have quite a few waiting in the wings, some of which have been updated to 2018 spec, which involved adding some new hard points to the chassis to attach the new bodywork to, and changing the roll hoop for the removal of the air box that was there through the season. We had had to switch one of our chassis out earlier this year when we had some damage to the car. That chassis has now been repaired, and it's sitting there in case we need it. Yeah, we keep four cars kind of as rollers, and then there's a couple of chassis we try to keep on deck, so to speak. And ideally, what our goal is to keep our Speedway car with the best body fit only as a Speedway car and run the other car as much as possible.
Sure.
Going into next season, when we have a bit more time to prepare, we'll probably have both cars body fit to the same level, and we'll have a little more flexibility on which one to run where. Some of these chassis have had repairs on them, so there are ones that we prefer for Speedways. There are some, when you repair them, they tend to gain a couple pounds, so you tend to try to not run those at the more weight-sensitive tracks. But for the most part, we've done torsion testing of the chassis, and we think they're extremely consistent and similar, so we don't spend too much time worrying about which chassis or which tub we bring to which track.
I think I got my new excuse, too. I've been through a lot of repairs. That's why I keep putting on a couple of pounds. That's it. I love that one. I'm going to use that going forward, man. Let's see. A couple other great questions to get to here before I get to one that I love, which reaches back into your maybe pre-engineering history here. Let's see. Ben Cohen, Chris, and MP, with the speculated schedule changes for 2019, what are your thoughts regarding the possibility of only four oval races, and what are the realistic possibilities that they're an oval edition in the next few years to at least increase the count? This coming with Phoenix obviously coming off the schedule, we know that Texas is up for renewal. It might be premature to say whether that will or won't happen. I know Texas Motor Speedway President Eddie Gossage, a huge fan of mine, has told a couple of friends in the industry that things are close with having IndyCar back, so we'll see where that leads. But what are your thoughts, Chris, if we do unfortunately dip down to only a handful of ovals next year? Is that a bad thing from your perspective as both a fan and a person in the paddock?
Well, as a fan of IndyCar racing, I think it's not a great thing. I think one of the unique things about IndyCar is that we race on four distinctly different types of tracks. You know, you got your permanent road courses, your street courses, your short ovals, and then your speedways. And I think that's unique to our championship, and it's a unique challenge for our drivers and our teams. So beyond the historical significance, I think it's a part of our DNA, so to speak. You know, I understand in the short term some business things happen and maybe the balance isn't great, but I think IndyCar's intention is certainly to keep all those disciplines in the fold. So hopefully they'll get everything put together with some tracks where we have some great fans, and I know we have a lot of great fans around the country, and there's some tracks that we'd like to get back to as racers, and I'm sure there's some tracks that were or some areas of the country that we're underserving at the moment where there are some great fans. So hopefully we'll get that all sorted out in the next few weeks here.
Eric Franklin has a question about one of the most enigmatic IndyCar drivers in the past 10 or 15 years. It says, Marshall, we used to joke in our house that Will Power didn't seem to have the attention span to win the Indy 500. He said that's now been proven wrong. This was based on his first response to every question about something going wrong being, I don't know, man, ... He said, you know him well. Is that a defense mechanism to keep from giving a politically incorrect answer? Or does he just have the red mist in the car and really doesn't know? Eric, I'll tell you, Will is a man with many, many thoughts going through his head at all times. I know that might not come across that way. Sometimes I bet he might even seem the exact opposite, like there's not much going on upstairs, but he is a guy whose brain is constantly, constantly working. So at least for what you see behind the wheel, and I'm sure as Chris can attest, that guy's animal instincts are just insane. He has the ability to take whatever, you know, the multiple voices and conversations and whatnot that tend to float around that brain of his, push them to the side, and really just get into full attack mode. But when he's out of the car, or even if he's sitting on pit lane, I mean, if you watch and or listen, it takes a minute for him to kind of sort through all the things that are coming to him to get to a constructive answer on what he wants from the car and so on and so forth. And then when he gets out of the car, I think he just defaults to the don't say anything that's going to piss off Tim Cindric or Roger Penske if there is a problem. And this is all maybe coming from a point of, you know, he has an eternal meme that's going to follow him of flipping the double birds at Loudon and whatnot. So definitely one of the most complex characters you'll find in IndyCar, Eric. I wish, honestly, more drivers were as complex as Will. Because at least for me, and I don't know if you feel the same way, Chris, but complexity is, it's a wonderful thing. It's when you have a person, to me, where you can only talk about racing or only talk about one or two things, where I actually start to lose interest pretty quickly. But what do you think about good old DJ Willie P here in that that beautiful, crazy mind of his?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot going on in there. And, you know, he reminds me of a kid growing up a little bit. When you look at his career, you know, he was obviously super talented, one of the best qualifiers ever, super fast, and it did take him a little while to put the whole package together, but you know, he's worked hard at it. And I think it happened so slowly that maybe we didn't even see it happening. Someone asked me after Indy, you know, in pit lane, does this complete Will Power's resume? You know, I was thinking, well, I think Will Power's resume was pretty damn strong already. I was a bit taken aback, but you know, it's, obviously Indy is a big thing, but I think Will's resume was strong before Indy. For him, maybe it helps, maybe it doesn't. I don't know, but I think what you said is right. There's a lot going on in Will's mind, and it takes him a few minutes when he gets out of the car to process it all. But when he has that laser focus and gets in the zone, he's as fast as anybody, and you know, he's shown it so many times in qualifying. I really enjoyed the days, you know, in engineering Dario going up against Will, because you had two guys there in qualifying that would just do things that were superhuman. And those were fun times racing against Will in qualifying, and it's still fun racing against him now. Dixon's maybe not as big a qualifier, but and I think if you look at his statistics, you'll even see that. Not that he's slow, but it's not his forte. Winning races is Scott's forte, and I feel like Will comes in from a little bit different angle than Scott.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the number, and not picking on Will here, but if you look at the number of championships that Will was vying for and then came up short. He finally put the puzzle together in 2014, but yeah, definitely a little bit of the inverse, and I think he has only improved in that area as time has gone by. But we could be talking about Power, a three-time champion right now, if, as I wrote many times back in the day when you were engineering Dario, if he were to apply the Dario template of, yes, winning is wonderful, but if I have a fifth-place car and I can get a third place out of it, that's actually the smarter move than being bound and determined to be first and then, you know, bouncing off the wall and getting almost no points. So he has definitely come a long way in that regard. Let's see. All right, here's a good one, reaching back into your previous life. John Karasinski says, was it difficult, Chris, stepping away from driving and moving into a full engineering role following your Indy Lights career, and also having raced against some of the modern greats, Kanaan, Castroneves, DeMott, etc.? Who sticks out from your racing career as the toughest competitors you faced?
It was difficult to step away at the time, but it was kind of forced by a lack of interest in my driving services and a lack of money to pay for it myself, so there wasn't a lot I could do about it. Even when I was driving, you know, when I went to college, I didn't know whether I wanted to be in engineering or in business to help my driving career along, so I decided I'd do both. And I think that's served me well, because even as an engineer, there's plenty of times I've drawn upon that management experience, and it was tough to step away from, but it was something that I always wanted to be at the top. And when that kind of fizzled out for me in Indy Lights, and the opportunity wasn't there to move up that next rung, I started looking around for other things to do, and it just so happened that my brother was coming up, and I went to race for Team Green in the same chassis that I had driven. So I was out of racing for a little over a year, and then got the call, hey, would you be interested in coming in engineering? I mean, in that time I'd been helping my brother in the Dodge Pro Series, and I said, you know, that doesn't sound like such a bad deal, and I knew a lot of the people that were on the team and took the plunge, and it's been full steam ahead from there. So yeah, it's been a fun experience, and I don't regret anything about it. As far as guys that were super fast, you know, I used to joke with Tony that I taught him everything he knows about oil racing, because Tony came up racing go-karts, I came up through quarter midgets, so Tony didn't know much about ovals getting into Indy Lights, and I was probably stronger on ovals than I was on road courses, so I think Tony's done pretty well, and I'm sure I didn't teach him everything he knows, but it's fun to joke about. But yeah, Tony was great in Indy Lights. He seemed to be a little more, I don't want to say calm, but you know, in those Indy Lights championships, he was able to keep it together under the pressure where Helio wasn't at the time. Helio's obviously has withstood the test of time and is another great driver. And you know, there was so many great guys in Indy Lights back then that were fun to race with. But I think the guy that had maybe the most complete package was Cristiano D'Amata.
Yeah.
You know, and before he got injured, he was really a force to be reckoned with. And I think that's why you saw him get to Formula One and do some great things. But yeah, he was, at that time, I would have said he was probably the most complete package.
Another thing too worth mentioning, and maybe you'll enjoy revealing the acronym, the full meaning of the acronym, but you both raced for a family-based team, the mighty SOTARE, and also got a call, and you know, were brought into a bigger program in Lights as well. So you were one of the, to me at least, one of the quality drivers who's also fortunate to be recognized for your efforts kind of on the home front on a budget endeavor to, you know, be given a shot with one of the bigger Lights teams as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Sotari, as we called it, started out back when we were doing quarter midgets. We actually built engines, not just for ourselves. We did a few for some other people, and a friend of my dad's that owned a machine shop that we did some work in and shared some space with said, you guys need a name. So that's what we came up with. State-of-the-art race engines was what it was originally. And then we changed it to state-of-the-art race engineering. And, I think I still got some stationery here in the office somewhere that's got that on it. So
you got to bust that out. I got to see that at Mid Ohio. That's great. And
I'll see what I can find there.
Yeah, and then but you also got the call too, you know, to do a little bit more than just driving for the family team too. So again, that's always kind of the measure of whether you're piquing people's interest, and you don't get folks inquiring if you don't have talent.
Yeah, there's a bit of a funny story there. I was, you know, I'd done F2000 for a few years and done real well, and then kind of took a bit of a hiatus to finish college for a year, and only raced one race in Howard Katz's car, actually, at New Hampshire, and won there, and things were kind of slow. I was trying to put something together, trying to get into Indy Lights, and I got the call from Barry Green to come test out in Phoenix. At the time, I was living in Mays Landing, New Jersey. I just graduated from college, and that's where I ended up for the time being, and I'm like, yeah, great. Yeah, this is awesome. I'm going to get a chance and go out there and test at Firebird. And next thing you know, there's a blizzard. and they close the road between Mays Landing and Philadelphia, where I need to fly out of. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to miss this test. And I'm trying to figure out how to get there. You know, I grew up in New England. If I had a four-wheel drive, I'd have driven through it. But my Honda that I had at the time wasn't quite going to make it through 2 feet of snow.
Mm.
So luckily they got the highway open. I got out there, and Greg Ray had already tested, and they had a couple other drivers that had tested, and I got there in time to do my half day of testing, and luckily it went well, and led to a 3-year Indy Lights career for me, and ultimately got me noticed as an engineer and into what I'm doing today. You know, I didn't make it as a driver, but I'm still involved in the sport and love it. So
it was fun too, because having worked with Greg Ray in Atlantic, then later actually in the good old Indy Racing League, it was fun. I guess we felt good for him. General Racing, seeing him get picked up by the cool sponsored Barry Green effort. And then it was not only fun seeing you partner with him, but it was even better being behind Mark Hotchkiss and Dave DeSilva, hoping to beat Greg in 96. So that was kind of fun, too.
Yeah, those Genoa cars were tough competition.
Yeah, well, it was good times. All right, well, we got about 15 minutes left before we need to let you go, so I'm going to blast through a couple of questions, jumping back and forth between Facebook and Twitter. Vincent Anderson, great question. Definite strong candidate for question of the week. If Scott Dixon was a superhero or supervillain, which one would he be?
It's hard to picture Scott Dixon as a supervillain. So I'm going to have to go with a superhero. And
that's a tough one. I got to admit, nothing's jumping right out for me.
I don't know. I think I'd probably just go with Superman, because if you see Scott Dixon on the street, you would never pick him out as the third most winning IndyCar driver in history. He's just Clark Kent.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. I mean, the Superman thing, you know, Dixie's not exactly a big imposing physical presence, but yeah, it's a perfect way of putting it, though. You throw that guy in the phone booth,
he's not a big imposing physical presence, but the guy goes out and does Ironmans, and I happened to be out camping with him one weekend years ago.
And he killed a bear with his hands.
No, we were partaking in some adult beverages till a fairly early hour of the morning, and we all went to sleep and got up, and where's Scott? Oh, he went to do a sprint triathlon. And he won it, because that's what he does.
Yeah, that's great. No, but that's a perfect way of putting it, though, because the guy puts on the cape and does crazy things in his professional life, takes it off, and kind of blends into the crowd, which, that's not a bad thing, man. Not everybody comes out of the womb wanting the spotlight and cameras and, you know, craves attention just for living. Some like to do their job, do it well, and then go home and be a normal person. And I don't think you can fault Dixie for that at all. I mean, how's this? AJ Foyt, one of the most celebrated people of all time in our profession, Chris. I don't know of a person who hates being bothered by fans. No, I ain't signing that damn autograph. Hell no. I mean, and that isn't a new thing. So maybe I shouldn't pull back the cover here too much. But there's while he is massively celebrated, good old AJ is not exactly someone who likes to be bothered, even by his friends, much less those who don't know him. All right, Grayson Gibson. Awesome question, too. Definite contender. Chris, what's the funniest radio transmission you've received from Scott?
Well, I don't know. They're usually pretty calm, but I don't know. This was not funny at the time, but we were at St. Pete a few years back, and it was second practice on Friday, and we changed gears between sessions. Scott went out, and, you know, he's still on the outlap, and radio transmissions weren't that great at St. Pete back then, so it was a little garbled, but we got I've got 2/3. I'm not kidding.
2/3 gears.
Yeah, two third gears, which turns out it wasn't really two third gears. It was a third then a second, which was even worse. But you know, mistakes happen. We actually got that one corrected during the session and got back out. But at the time, not very funny. But in hindsight, something we laugh about now.
Got a couple folks, Chris, who've asked in a variety of ways, other than Dixie. Are there any other drivers throughout racing history, and I guess this go all the way back, you wish you could have or would like to engineer if that possibility somehow became available?
Well, I don't know if anybody really engineered him, but you know, I got a copy of The Unfair Advantage right here on my shelf in front of me.
Ooh.
Mark Donahue would have been a really fun guy to engineer, I think. And like I said, I don't know if anybody really engineered him. I think he engineered himself, but yeah, he would have been fun to work with. You know, there's a long list of guys. You know, my hero growing up was Senna. I'm sure I'm not alone in that. And there were a long list of guys, but yeah, Senna, Donahue, you know, the Big Eagle, Dan Gurney, all those guys would have been fun, and especially Dan and Mark Donahue, guys that saw both the engineering side and the driving side, and were really great at both of them. Would have been fun to work with.
Absolutely. A question here from me from Keith Lee. Interesting one. I probably should have offered this info years ago, but I guess it didn't occur to me. He says, how do you decide what races to attend and cover? He said, I got to admit, I've missed the post-practice and qualifying and race coverage the last couple of IndyCar rounds. Great question, Keith. I can tell you the one thing that has been decimated in recent years in motor racing in general. This isn't specific to IndyCar. This is reporters in any and everything, or travel budgets. And as Chris can tell you, the travel portion of what it takes to go and do these races, whether you're reporting on them, engineering, driving, it's a big, big number each year. And I'm really fortunate that Racer is committed to getting me to as many races as possible. There are some limits, though. Again, it's just crazy expensive. So you also have the fact that I cover IMSA in sports car racing as well. So there are times where there are conflicts where I might be going to the sports car race instead of the IndyCar race. And then there are times, frankly, where we say, okay, well, Robin is at every round as part of the NBCSN family. That travel is taken care of through those means. So there are just some times where we say, you know, it would cost a whole heck of a lot to have two of us from Racer at whatever event. So we're going to try and rely on Robin to be on the ground and file a couple things, and I'll try and report remotely as best as I can. So, and that is also, frankly, Keith, that it's the reason why there's maybe four or five of us who cover IndyCar full-time these days instead of back in the day when there were lots and lots. Travel budgets have been the one thing absolutely slashed by most media outlets. So it's the reason why I'm not at every round of everything I cover. So there's the answer to that. We have another question or two, Chris, on the topic of schedule and WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca. One of them, which is interesting, comes in from Carlos Villalobos on Twitter. He says, why is the Laguna Seca fee lower if the race is hosted 1 week prior or after IMSA? Don't understand it. And that, Chris, comes from the proposal made by IndyCar to the county, which was accepted. And in that publicly available document, it was listed that the sanction fee for 2019, 20, and 21 would be $1.5 million. For 2019, though, if the IndyCar race was scheduled 1 week on either side of IMSA, it would actually be $300,000 less. And at the time, I didn't have a real answer for that because I was waiting to speak with Mark Miles, which I did yesterday, and they explained because they really did not want to have that happen. So they wanted to do all they could to get as far away from a race date as possible from IMSA. So, and that's not because they dislike IMSA, just obviously they don't want to be the ones following IMSA and suffer the possibilities of fewer people turning up. So at least speaking with the series, they are fairly well convinced that next year's season finale at Laguna, September 20th through 22nd, will have a decent amount of distance between IMSA's stop at the track. So, anyways, long story short, they didn't want it to happen, and I guess we're trying to look at ways to put that into words, although for me, I would have thought it would have been a higher fee, something that actually cost the county a lot more money if they were to put them together instead of create some separation. So, anyways, bit confusing there maybe in the proposal, Carlos, but they definitely do not want to be back-to-back, so sounds like that won't happen. Other thing that's interesting on this topic, Chris, is we've been hearing rumors, and I can't say that I have this on the record, but I'm fairly confident in it, that we had the Speedway Motorsports Incorporated-owned Sonoma Raceway circuit telling IndyCar, yeah, we would like to return, but A, since we have a new contract we need to come up with, we're going to need to do something like 50% the sanction fee that we've previously had. The rumors of it was about the same $1.5 million, so asking for it to be somewhere in the $750,000 range. Then also they have their own proximity clause, which at least for them would knock out the possibility of hosting an IndyCar race if Laguna Seca came onto the calendar. So I think those are two things that have led to a situation where we're awaiting official news from Sonoma. But I did get a call from the series yesterday while I was driving home from Monterey to say that they did speak with Sonoma, and Sonoma reiterated that their proximity clause and the chance of having two races in the area now that Laguna Seca confirmed is definitely not something they're going to pursue. So while we don't have the official announcement that Sonoma is done from the track, it sounds like at least in their communications with the series, it's little more than a formality that we won't be going back to Sonoma.
Yeah, that's sad news for us. We enjoyed Sonoma, and sure, it would have been nice to race at both tracks, and I know that's not possible at this point in time, but hopefully in the future we can make it make sense for not only IndyCar, but for the promoters also.
Let's get to a couple more quick questions, and we are going to bid farewell to this week's Week in IndyCar episode. Francesco Sata, love this question. Says, Chris, I'd like to know the difference in driving style between Dixon and Franchitti. I know it's basically a neutral oversteer versus understeer kind of thing, but nobody knows it better than you. And then the second question is, how much do you rely on data analysis versus driver feedback in your engineering decisions?
Much has been talked about different driving styles between Scott and Dario. But to be honest, the car setups weren't that different. We just knew there was a couple things we had to do to change Scott's setup to make it a little more friendly for Dario and vice versa. Basically, it comes down to Scott doesn't like the front to have any sort of deviation from where he wants it to go, and he's okay with the rear moving around a bit as a consequence of that. Whereas Dario was the other way. He'd rather have the front give up a little bit, and he'd ease off the steering a little bit to get the tire back, but he didn't want the rear to step out at all. So, their ideal cars sound light years apart, but really the car setups were quite similar, and it was just a little tweak of rear spring or damper or rear toe that would turn Scott's car into Dario's car when we were really on top of things and had some pretty good setups going. It was pretty easy to adapt one for the other.
And how about reliance on tools, whether it is words from your driver or data? And I ask that knowing that you're someone who probably straddles both worlds better than some, since a lot of what you had to do coming up was figuring it out without plugging into something.
Yeah, it definitely takes both, and I think that's one advantage I have with the driving experience is I can kind of get from the driver what the driver's saying, how that relates to car setup a bit more than maybe someone who hasn't been able to drive around some of these tracks. But the data is important too, and we have a lot of it. In fact, we have so much of it that we can't look at it quickly enough. So during a session, a lot of times you're going off driver comments and And then afterwards, you get time to look at the data a bit more and dive into why he's feeling the bump too much in this corner or whatever. So it's definitely a mix. But in pit lane, a lot of times you're going off driver comments, and then between sessions, a bit more off the data.
All right, two more we're going to blast through, and then say farewell. And they're both from Tim's. Tim Calabro, who always sends in great questions. Thank you, Tim. Says, to what extent do teams or drivers use video replays to analyze performance? Is it a way to more study yourself or opponents? And is race control footage made available from IndyCar, or do you just have to go on your own cameras or broadcast footage?
As far as I know, race control footage isn't made available. When a situation comes up and you go review it with the officials, sometimes they'll show you what they saw with the pit exit line or whatever. So they're not withholding it, but it's not generally available. It's not like the NFL where every team gets footage of every other team every week. What is available is in-car cameras. We can put our own team camera on in sessions that aren't televised, and IndyCar is working on standardizing that a bit more across teams for the future so that it doesn't interfere with the broadcast camera so much. And we do look at that. The drivers look at that from year to year, and also from session to session. Scott will study Toronto 2017 before we start running for 2018. And there's also technology out there to overlay cars, both from on-car footage or from footage from outside of the car. We've made use of all of those. We don't use too much of that at the moment from a cost standpoint, but it's something we used quite a bit last year.
10-4. All right, last question goes to Tim Falkowitz. This is awesome. So, IndyCar decides to take a page from NASCAR and Robin Miller, and you get the call to help you win at Indy next year, Chris. They offer you an extra 20 horsepower or 50 pounds of downforce. Which do you take?
20 horsepower every time at Indy. It would have to be a lot more downforce to equal out at Indy, but even then, horsepower is king at Indy, and drag's important. If it was a horsepower versus drag question, it might be a different answer, but in this case, definitely the horsepower. And we have numbers. I don't have them in front of me for how much downforce would equate to 20 horsepower, but all that changes a bit. In qualifying in particular, if you had 50 more pounds of downforce, you probably wouldn't go any faster. You might even go slower, but 20 horsepower is going to make you faster every time.
I love it. Mr. Simmons, I don't know if we even got to half the questions, so I'm actually going to try and take some time here and answer the ones myself after the episode goes up. All those that we didn't get to, I'm going to try and answer as many as I can just directly on Facebook and Twitter. But thank you so much, not only for spending time with us, but also connecting with the fans that you've built, and also just being a constant source of help for what we do on the reporting side to try and help IndyCar's story with either a little bit of technical information to help explain things, or just always being there to help try and bring the sport home to the existing fans and to new fans as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun, and I look forward to maybe doing it again in the future.
All right. Well, thanks again for listening in to the Week in... I was about to say the Week in Sports Cars. Boy, my brain is farting already, but thanks for listening into the Week in IndyCars and the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires and supported this month by the Justice Brothers. And with all that, we will speak to you next week.